It was a week ago last Saturday that the massive landslide devastated the area near Oso, but it was a well-documented risk in that area.
There was a fair bit of certainty that this was going to be a really bad landslide someday.
Geologist Dan McShane, we've heard that some people knew Oso was a risky place to live, but Seattle itself is a city built on top of a fault line after fault line, and we still live here, and we still build here. So when a natural disaster hits, some people often think, okay, this is going to be the wake-up call against living in a dangerous place. But Dr. Erwin Redliner says these wake-up calls are rarely heeded. He's director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University. Dr. Redliner, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Why isn't it a wake-up call when something as horrific as this takes place?
Well, you know, it turns out the United States does not do wake-up calls very well. That includes after other major disasters, even ones of far greater scope than this tragedy that happened in Washington State. And I refer you to Katrina, to 9/11, to tornadoes in Oklahoma last year, et cetera, that there's a tremendous amount of initial attention when the event is unfolding in the immediate days to follow. But when the spotlight is down, the media goes away. And I've been to, I can't tell you how many lessons learned conferences in the aftermath of almost all these disasters. But the fact is that we go on to other issues, we have a short attention span, and we don't really have the resources to translate experiences into actual lessons learned that are actionable. And that's a problem. You know, just to give you a quick example, we had the levee failure in the situation with Katrina in New Orleans, but we also have extraordinarily fragile levees all around the Sacramento River Valley and threatening the city of Sacramento, California. And we knew about this, and we still know about it, and very little has happened to try to ameliorate that. So this is a big cultural question you're asking about why we don't do better and why we don't make the investments that allow us to say that we actually learned a lesson and are doing something about it.
There's the big question of who is the we are talking about. You're the director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness. You are more aware of this than most people are. Folks who pay attention to the news are probably aware that there's an earthquake fault here in Seattle. They're somewhat aware of it. Does awareness bring with it respect for the danger and action?
Well, unfortunately, awareness does not necessarily have anything to do with actions that are taken. The actions that we're talking about would be, you know, studies, strategies developed, and then resources applied to fix the problems that have been identified. I'm talking to you from my office in New York City, and I'm standing on a fault line that is really a significant fault line in New York City, and there's the New Madrid fault lines that run through the middle of the country, and not to mention the ones that everyone's aware of on the West Coast. And so you'd think that ideally we would say that there shouldn't be a structure built in these areas that are on fault lines that have not been appropriately reinforced during construction or maybe re-engineered after we find out about them. But the fact is this requires a phenomenal investment, and we're just the will to do this seems to have waned quite a bit in the last few decades. And so here we are standing on our respective fault lines on the West Coast and the East Coast and asking these profound questions about what are we going to do about it. And it's really, you know, it's something that we have awareness, but we don't have the will or potentially the money to act on it.
Well, Dr. Redliner, we're both on fault lines, and yet here we are. is there something cognitive going on in our minds where we know there's a risk, but we're not that worried about the risk? I've heard the theory that humans in general have an optimism bias. I know there's a fault line here, but I'm pretty sure it's not going to hit while I'm here.
Right, and actually, the question is how to evaluate these risks. And yes, I'm from I run an academically based think tank policy research shop here at Columbia. But the fact of the matter is that the assessment of risk is a very complex phenomenon that involves the probability of hazards actually occurring, how much risk we're willing to take, et cetera. You know, there's about 90 million Americans who actually live in a potential earthquake risk zone. There's people who live along the coasts of our country and countries all around the world, who some do so because they like the view, and others do so because they that's where their work is, along the coast, and they're fishing and they're whatever else is necessary for the economy. So taking risk is an inherent reality of human existence on the planet. But evaluating how much risk we're willing to take as individuals, and more importantly, I think from the policy point of view, or the allocation of our resources, you know, it becomes a question of how much are we going to invest to protect us from these risks, and it comes down to, we would think, hopefully a place where the science and the evidence and the numerical assessment of risk meet the policymakers and the men and women who decide how much money we're going to spend on whatever amelioration needs to be done. But, you know, the American Society of Civil Engineers says it would take about $3.7 trillion with a TR dollars to fix all of the aging infrastructure in America. We had a gas line explosion here in New York City recently that killed a number of people. But we have, you know, thousands of miles of 100-plus-year-old pipelines, not only in our city, but similarly in other cities around the country. But if we wanted to fix all that, and by the way, you know, $3.7 trillion is a lot of money, but if you think about that, it's maybe $370 billion a year for 10 years. What an extraordinary job creation machine that would be. Millions of people would need to be put to work there, and we'd end up with a much more resilient society.
Sure, and but one might think that with all the people in New York City that might be facing a risk like this, and all the people in Seattle and the people in smaller communities that are facing big risks, they'd be applying political pressure for the expenditures on emergencies. But the public interest putting pressure on the politicians to pay for the money to have better disaster preparedness seems to fade away.
That's right. But you know what it comes right down to, and you ask someone who lives in a risk area, you might even ask, you know, residents in Seattle, how much more taxes would you be willing to pay to make your city more resilient, or are you going to spin that roulette wheel and just kind of see what happens? And I think that's really what it boils down to, and especially when we have, I don't want to cast aspersions, but such a dysfunctional congressional political process right now in Washington. It doesn't seem that they're even capable or willing to have just a rational discussion about what we need to do for the public interest.
Yeah.
You know, we're having these ideological battles when, you know, we have other real problems that we should be sorting
Absolutely.
Out.
Absolutely.
Not a great time. Yeah.
That certainly does not help. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Erwin Redliner. We appreciate it.
Oh, sure. Thank you.
Dr. Redliner directs the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University's Earth Institute. He's also the author of Americans at Risk, Why We Are Not Prepared for Mega Disasters and What We Can Do. With David Hyde, I'm Ross Reynolds. This is The Record.